The Art of Discernment, Season 3, Episode 2. What did America's founders believe?
Hello and welcome to The Art of Discernment. I'm Dr. Bob Dixon, Chair of the Communication Department here at the Masters University. And my guest here with me is Dr. Greg Fraser, Dean of our John P. Stead School of Humanities. Dr. Fraser is also Professor of History and Political Studies and author of The Religious Beliefs of America's Founders, Reason, Revelation, and Revolution. He also wrote an article on the faith of the Founding Fathers for the university's website, which continues to be one of our most read articles each month. We'll reference that article during today's discussion. Dr. Fraser, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
So let me jump right in. Why does it matter for Christians and society at large to have an accurate account and understanding of the Founding Fathers' religious beliefs?
Well, first of all, we believe in truth. And we believe that truth is important. And so I think that just off the top, it's important if we know the truth about something, that that's what we believe and that's what we teach. And so that's really kind of at the base of it. But there are a lot of reasons why it matters. Probably the most significant these days is that we want people's focus and people's attention on what really matters in the long run. In other words, if one believes, for example, that America was founded as a Christian nation on biblical principles and so on and so forth, and then one says, we have to go back to that, and they focus all of their attention, their resources, their time, their money on trying to fix the world through political processes, then that's problematic. I believe that our trust when it comes to politics, as in every other area, has to be in God. And, you know, Jesus taught that the world is sinful and wicked and in trouble because men love the darkness, not because we need just one more congressman or one more Supreme Court justice or just the right president. That isn't going to fix America's moral problem. America's moral problem is in the hearts of men, that they love the darkness, that they love their sin. And so really only the church has the answer to the moral problems of America. And trying to reach that through some type of moralizing system of government or That type of thing just isn't, it's not going to work, and it's not what we should be doing. We should be putting our, laying up treasure in heaven, and we should be seeking the kingdom, not the republic.
Before we dive into all the details of this conversation, can you just make a distinction between the founding fathers and then just generally people who lived during the founding era and how, why it's important to differentiate those voices?
Yeah. So those, first of all, the founding fathers is a rather amorphous term. People kick it around like it's a group of guys who all believe the same things, and they didn't. And it's dangerous to say, to start a sentence with the founding fathers believed or the founding fathers said, unless you're talking about the Constitution, which they agreed on and wrote. Other than that, they were individuals who had individual beliefs and understandings and viewpoints and whatnot. But aside from that, the big distinction between the American founders and the people as a whole at that time is American founders were much more highly educated. And they were educated in Enlightenment thought and rationalism. And so that's a huge distinction. Not only were the founding fathers, the political figures, educated in Enlightenment thought, but so were most of the ministers of the period. And then the people just relied upon them because they were educated to lead them and to teach them and so on and so forth. But people sometimes talk about, you know, the common people of that era were churchgoers and whatnot. And Actually, that's a big debate in historical circles as to the extent to which they were churchgoers. But even to the extent that they were churchgoers, what they were being taught from the pulpit was Enlightenment rationalism. In fact, most people don't know that the whole reason that Yale was started was because the ministers were being taught at Harvard and congregations were complaining that their ministers that they were getting didn't know the gospel and didn't believe the gospel. And so Yale was started to kind of return to that, and within 10 years, it had gone down the tubes as well. So, that's the big distinction is that the people we call the founding fathers were more highly educated, and that was an Enlightenment thought.
So, what did the founding fathers believe? If it wasn't what we think of when we say Christianity,
well. Again, I won't say the founding fathers because many of the founding fathers were Christians. There were Christians among the founding fathers, contrary to popular belief. So when I started this, when I wrote this book and I delved into the religious beliefs of the founders, one of the things I wanted to dispel was the idea that the founders were all deists or rank secularists. And in fact, hardly any of them were deists. You have to go pretty far down the list. If you start listing founding fathers, you have to go pretty far down the list before you find any deists. And you can name two or three that are way down the list in terms of what people would know. So there were hardly any deists to start with. So the left is wrong, and they weren't secularists either. They were religious. The Supreme Court is completely wrong in their wall of separation notion. Nobody believed in that. Even Jefferson, that they quote it from, didn't believe in it the way the court applies it. So they believed, they wanted religion in public life. They believed that it was important to have religion in public life for reasons we can maybe get into later. But they weren't deists, so the left was wrong. But I argue that the right was also wrong. They weren't Christians for the most part. There were Christians among the founding fathers for sure, but the most influential founders, the ones that were most influential in terms of the founding documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and in terms of putting the system into place, were what I call theistic rationalists. They weren't Christians, they weren't deists, they were something in the middle. Theistic rationalism is a belief system that takes from Protestant Christianity and takes from Enlightenment rationalism. And then what they did was they were raised in sort of Christendom in an age and in a world that had some sort of nominal Christianity at its base. So they understood Christianity. The Bible was in everybody's home. It was the only book that was published like that. And so they were familiar with the Bible and Christianity. But they had problems with it, the irrationality of the Bible at times, what they thought was irrational, supernatural things and so forth. And so, and then they were taught in their advanced training in the university, they were taught Enlightenment rationalism, but they didn't completely swallow that either because they thought parts of that were irrational as well. So what they did was they took from Enlightenment rationalism certain things and from Protestant Christianity, certain things, and they melded it together into sort of their own belief system, which I've termed theistic rationalism. It's theistic because they believe in a present God, unlike the deists who believed in an absent God. But it's fundamentally rationalism. The deciding factor, they believe that Protestant Christianity and rationalism, Enlightenment thought, will take you to the same place most of the time. But when the roads diverge, they went with rationalism, with reason. And so they took the elements that they thought were reasonable from Christianity and reasonable from Enlightenment thought and created this kind of unique belief system.
This theistic rationalism, in what ways did it influence their thinking and as they founded this country?
Well, again, they discarded for the most part, anything supernatural. Now, some of them believed in miracles only because they thought it was rational that a powerful God could do miracles. Others believe that it was miracles were irrational because they believed that this God, whoever he was, had created everything and set everything running according to certain laws, certain natural laws. You see that in the very beginning of the Declaration of Independence, for example, the laws of God, of nature and nature's God. And so they thought it was irrational for a perfect and powerful God to create a system of laws and then violate them with miracles. So some didn't believe in miracles, some thought it was rational, so on and so forth. You find this language in the Declaration of Independence quite a bit, and they use what I call God words in the Declaration of Independence. They're not biblical terms for God. The only biblical term for God in the Declaration is creator, and everybody believed in a creator then. The deists did too, because there was no other option. It was before Darwin, and everybody believed in a creator. So there aren't any biblical terms. Jefferson, being a theistic rationalism, which I argue that he was, wrote the Declaration of Independence, I think very artfully, that's the word that I use. He wrote it to appeal to the different religious camps, but not ultimately offend anybody. That's why today, 200 years later, secularists can say, oh, it's a rationalist secular document, and Christians say, oh, it's a Christian document, and Jews aren't offended by it either. Everybody's okay with it because he wrote it in such a way, as theistic rationalists did, to try to appeal to all the various groups because they didn't have a dog in the race. For theistic rationalists, the thing that was important about religion, and they thought religion was important. Let me just mention this. So you're going to create a republic, a free government with free people. So the fundamental question in government is the obligation question. Why should people obey? Or how do you get people to obey? And in a totalitarian system or an absolutist system, it's simple. You have an iron fist that makes people obey. But what do you do in a free society? And their answer was morality. You have to have morality in a free society. And so that's where religion comes into play, because religion teaches morality. Religion produces morality. That's why George Washington, for example, in his farewell address, keeps talking about religion and morality, And for many of them, that was like one word, religion and morality, because that was the purpose of religion. And you need to have religion in public life to have morality to help govern society. And so that's why they need religion in society. But they didn't like doctrines because doctrines were divisive, and they wanted people to be united. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin, who gave to all the churches in Philadelphia, and he said late in his life, as I go out of this life, I hope to have not offended anyone. You know, Franklin's sort of that way. He's kind of touching all the bases, and that's kind of a similar thing to to the rest of them. But anyway, so this morality is the critical thing that you need in public life, and not specific doctrines or churches, because those are divisive. Franklin once said of a pastor that he didn't have any use for him because he was more interested in making people good Presbyterians than good citizens.
Okay. I've heard that. That's funny. I've heard, and we've all heard, you know, the Puritans, they founded America. They founded this country. And in your article, you refute that assumption that happened. You say, no, it was the Puritans founded something, but it was Massachusetts. And talk a bit about that and why that's important to distinguish.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the people who want to make the Christian America argument always start with the Puritans. Well, it's not the first colony. Jamestown was the first colony. It's not the largest colony. Why do we focus all of our attention on that? Well, because it was founded by Puritans, and they want to make that case. Mm-hmm. But they didn't found the United States. This is 160 years before the founding of the United States. And so And they founded this one region, But there are 13 states ultimately that create the United States, and Massachusetts is only one of them. Why all the focus on that? Why does that determine for everybody else? Some of the states had religious influence. Maryland was heavily influenced by Catholics. Why don't we say it's a Catholic thing? Two of the states were founded by people who were kicked out of the Puritan colonies. Roughly seven of the states had no religious influence whatsoever. I just don't think it makes any sense to. And by the way, we should also note that the Puritan experiment was basically done before you even get out of the 1600s. Before you get to the 1700s, the Puritans are involved in the slave trade. They're making rum and selling rum on a large scale. They've massacred Indian tribes. So even before you get to the 1700s, the Puritan Commonwealth, as we talk about it, is basically already gone, and it's pretty secularized.
You also mentioned that some founders had a different understanding of Christianity compared to contemporary evangelicals. Can you unpack that a little for us?
Yeah, some of the founders spent a lot of time studying religion and religions, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin in particular. And it's interesting because John Adams is often the one that everybody says, oh, here's proof that it's a Christian nation, because he was in a Congregationalist church and here's a Reformed guy. People still make that claim, even though that church turned Unitarian when he was in college. Was one of the first Unitarian churches in New England that is, you know, not believing the deity of Christ. And Adams, even at that age, in his journal, referred to the deity of Christ as an absurdity and the atonement by Christ as an absurdity. And he's kind of actually the quintessential theistic rationalist because he had more sort of Christian influence than some of the others. Again, took certain elements out of it, but rejected the rest. And those guys, Jefferson and Adams in particular, who studied religion and religions a lot more and interacted a lot in their letters about that, they specifically rejected virtually the whole Masters University doctrinal statement, especially anything Calvinist. It's ironic because one of my friends that I just debated the other night at another school constantly refers to John Adams as a reformer because he was at a Congregationalist church, not looking at what he actually believed or what the church believed, but it was a Reformed denomination, so therefore. And Adams and Jefferson had this thing that they did with each other when they were excoriating Calvinism, in which Adams at one point said to Jefferson, "I wish you good health until I believe even one element of Calvinism, because that would make you immortal." And so they were pretty adamant about rejecting the deity of Christ, salvation by faith, the atonement. You go pretty much down the doctrinal statement. Original sin, they rejected virtually all the elements of fundamental real Christianity, because they found them to be irrational.
It's hard to not start denying things in Scripture if you really want everything to be rational, to make sense to you when we're talking about the mind of God. But that makes sense.
Yeah, they denied the veracity of Scripture. What they did was unlike deists, this is another way in which they were not deists. Unlike deists, they didn't reject all written revelation, but their standard for what counted as written revelation was what they thought was reasonable. So parts of Scripture that they thought were reasonable, they accepted those as revelation from God, which means ultimately they're God. They're determining what is valid revelation and what isn't. That's why Jefferson famously or infamously cut up the New Testament and the Gospels, I should say, cut up the Gospels, cut out all everything supernatural and miraculous and then pasted it back together and created his own sort of version of the New Testament, which is still in print today. It's called the Jefferson Bible. That isn't what he called it. But so he believed Jesus was a great moral teacher. This is what the theistic rationalists believed in general. Jesus was a great moral teacher, and that's it. And he wasn't God. He didn't come to die for the sins of mankind. He came to teach morality. And there are actually many roads to heaven. And Jefferson in particular, for example, talks about some of the ancient Greek religion and how he expects to see those people in heaven. And so he believed that Adams believed that the Shastra, which was a Hindu document, had the as great great a doctrine as the person of Christianity that he thought had the best Christian doctrine.
So, Thomas Jefferson, Mr. President, we thank you for the Declaration of Independence and your leadership. But we're sorry to tell you your admission to Masters University has been denied. If we pushed a doctoral statement across the table, he would not sign that.
No.
Interesting. You wrote that not a single founding father or founder claimed to intend the creation of a Christian nation. Why is the absence of that claim so important, and how does it challenge, you know, certain narratives that we hear about America's founding?
Yeah, well, you would think if in fact they collectively, the founding fathers, intended to create a Christian nation, which is what is said, that one of them at least would have said so. would have made that claim. The claim is made all the time today in reverse, but no one said it at the time. And you know they didn't, because if anyone had said it, it would be blazoned across the doorways of all the Christian schools of America, right? And over the libraries and so forth. There'd be big quotes and big block letters. Aside from a lot of other problems with evidence for that, to me, that's just kind of a glaring thing. It seems as if someone would have said so if that was actually their purpose.
Just going back to something you said earlier, it's kind of burning a question in my mind. When the founders assumed religion as sort of the moral binding to go along with the laws, what happens when the moral binding separates? What happens when we have sort of a wholesale abandonment of religion or kind of common morality that I think a lot of people would say is evident today? What happens then?
Well, what happens is what we have today, which is society coming apart. And they believed that you had to have a base of what they called civic virtue or public virtue. Now, that wasn't entirely what we think of as virtue. It was more political. But nonetheless, it was based on certain things such as people being willing to obey laws and rules without compulsion, without being forced to. And the fact that for years, I'll just offend everybody listening, the fact that for years people have said, well, I can violate the speed limit because they're not enforcing it, has taught generations of young people that the law isn't really itself really important. It's what you can get away with. And now you have people storming into Walgreens stores and stealing right up to $900 worth of stuff because they're not enforcing it. So the framers of the Constitution and most of the founders would have been appalled at the notion that you would teach young people that you can do it as long as they're not enforcing the law. Because one of their fundamental principles was for a free society was that the people have a respect for the law independent of whether it's being enforced or not. So that's just one element, but there's a lot of elements in which the society was based on a fundamentally moral base. And in the Federalist Papers, Publius says that a republican form of government doesn't work without virtue. The people have to have sufficient virtue is the term that he uses. And I would argue that we no longer do, and that's why things are coming apart. And let me just add to that too, by the way, that when they talked about having sufficient virtue and morality, again, it didn't have to be Christian morality or Christian virtue. Any religion would do. And they didn't specify Christianity. They studied all the religions, some of them, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson in particular, studied all the religions of the world. And they just came to the conclusion that all religions teach morality, and there are many roads to heaven is another thing that they believed. And they had their own notions of Christianity, which was basically doing good, being good. That for them was Christianity. And they thought it was absurd, things like the atonement and even the incarnation, they thought was absurd, that a God would come and take the form of lowly man and walk in mud and so on and so forth.
It is absurd.
It is. That's what I'm saying. That's why if rationalism is your centerpiece,
right?
That's not rational. That would happen. It's a totally irrational. It's a supernatural thing. And so they struggled with that kind of thing. So the reason, by the way, that they could, in the First Amendment, allow for freedom of religion is because, again, they didn't have a dog in the fight or a horse in the race. They didn't have a particular religion. And so I argued that they were actually establishing a religion. They were establishing theistic rationalism. They were establishing a system in which any religion will do, but religion is important.
You stated that promotion of the Christian America idea causes believers to confuse their cultural American heritage with biblical Christianity. What do you mean by that exactly? And what steps can believers do to, or what can they take? What steps can they take to avoid falling into that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, too many Americans worship a sort of tribal god of America. And we have these national holidays in which the ceremonies collect all the religions together and they all do this, that, and the other in celebrating these holidays. And so there's not really a distinctive Christian element. And there's too many people, because of the way they've been taught, now link Americanism with Christianity. And it's almost, in many cases, it is an idolatrous type of situation in which, now, for example, I go and speak at churches. And generally what I do is I don't give my own opinion. I just have a PowerPoint in which I show what they said they believe. They said this, they said this, they said this. And in their private writings, that's where you find out what they really believe, in their journals and in their diaries and in their personal correspondence. And I just show people what they believed. And most people, when I do this at churches, say, wow, I didn't know that. Okay, you know. And then some people will come up and be irate because I'm challenging, you know, this notion of America as a Christian nation. And in my view, they have so linked Americanism and Christianity that they can't separate them. And I think that's a very dangerous and deadly thing to do, because what you're doing is adding to the gospel. And that's not a good road to go down.
I hear complaints from the left. Oh, the right is trying to rejoin or put together the church and the state, you know. It doesn't sound like that was ever the intent for that to take place.
No. This wall of separation idea is just, I call it goofy. They did not want to separate religion from public life. They wanted, and there's all sorts of examples done by them. I mean, they held religious services in the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. Even Jefferson attended. So they absolutely wanted religion in public life. It just didn't have to be Christianity. In fact, they prefer that it weren't Christianity because Christianity is too singular and it's not all inclusive. Real Christianity is not all inclusive. But they wanted religion in public life because of the morality that they needed.
Do you think there's any way off of what feels like a precipice for our country, given that it feels like wholesale abandonment of that morality that the founders said was so crucial?
No.
Yeah.
No, I shouldn't say.
I was hoping for a better answer, but I believe you might be right.
That's my shocking answer. My real answer is, yes, there is hope if God decides to intervene.
Yeah.
God can do whatever he wants, and he can certainly turn everything around. And again, that's why our trust should be in him. It's not going to turn around if we elect, you know, a certain person president, or if we get the right Supreme Court justices. That can sort of stem the tide for a while. But fundamentally, America is what its people are. You know, the founders used to, some of the founders used to say that no constitution can indefinitely protect a foolish or vicious people. No matter what system you set up, if the people are fools, or vicious here doesn't mean like a Rottweiler, it means full of vice. Mm-hmm. If the people are fools or full of vice, then it doesn't matter what system you set up, eventually it's going to go down. And they were fond, by the way, of quoting and looking at the Roman Republic. And much of our legal system was based on the Roman Republic. And then they warned against what happened to the Roman Republic, which it went down and became a dictatorship. I see a lot of seeds of that, the same types of things that happened in the Roman Republic. So I don't think they'd be very comfortable today.
I could see what you're saying. If a general morality isn't restraining the people, then you need that iron fist that you believe you need the iron fist that you mentioned at the beginning of our podcast.
And look at how enthralled people become with charismatic individuals. You know, on the left, Barack Obama; on the right, Donald Trump. And when things get hard, people tend to look to strong individuals when things get difficult. And you know, that's the root. Many times, that was throw the thing you can't ever throw into an argument, but that was how Hitler came to power. That was how Mussolini came to power. Mm-hmm. That's how Franklin Roosevelt got elected to three terms, actually four terms as president, served three terms and was elected to four. People look to a strong leader when things aren't going well. So
this is a fascinating subject. It's historical, but it has, like all history, ramifications in the present. Where can our audience go to find out more about our founders and about maybe even where our country's been and where it's going?
Well, the best place is my book,
there
frankly,
you go. Yeah.
Because I coined this notion of theistic rationalism. And by the way, let me emphasize again, there were Christians among the founders. What I did in my book was look at eight key founders who were the most responsible for the founding documents and for putting it into play. And by the way, I went to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. looking at the documents. And when I was there, I don't know if they still have it there because they changed displays. But they had displays, they had individual displays around the semicircle in which they each one highlighted a key founding father. And of my eight people, seven of them were in the first eight displays. So I think they are legitimately the key people. But if I were to go to a ninth, he was a Christian. He was a solid Christian.
Who can you name him? Who was
Yeah, he? That's Roger Sherman.
Okay.
And John Jay, first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he was a Christian. So there were Christians among the founders. I'm not arguing that there weren't, but they weren't the most influential people. It's just like, you know, when you get into a meeting room or something, you have a room of 20, 30 people, but one or two people really control things and dominate things. But there are always certain key people, you know, and then think about Congress and so forth. There are certain key people, you know their names because they're the movers and the shakers. Well, these are the movers and shakers among the founders and the framers. But the ninth one would have been a Christian.
I should add that for our audience, all this material is part of the general ed curriculum here at Masters, that every student who comes here is going to take U.S. history, U.S. government, and they're going to learn directly from you, and they're going to read your book and going to have this framing that our audience is hearing right now. So important, so critical to to have a right view of who we are as a nation and what that means for us today. So
I'll mention another book too, just so it isn't entirely self-serving. There's also a book called The Search for Christian America. And it was co-written by Mark Knoll, who is arguably the preeminent Christian historian today. By the way, a blurb to my book. And I talked with him about it. And then George Marsden, another prominent person, and Nathan Hatch. So the three of them wrote this book, The Search for Christian America. It's out of print, so you'd have to get it at a used bookstore or something like that, a used book site online. But it also basically gives the same idea as mine.
Dr. Frazier, thank you so much for joining us today and for this conversation. It's always a joy to talk to you and a pleasure. And I always leave the conversation feeling smarter than when and much bit more well informed. No, smarter than I was.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for The Art of Discernment, a podcast of the Masters University. You can learn more about the university at masters.edu. Be sure to subscribe to The Art of Discernment wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're watching us on YouTube, subscribe to our channel. If you know someone who would benefit from today's show, we encourage you to share it with them. We'll see you next time.